As we talked, a yellowish light flashed on the panel, then blinked off and on. All of us looked toward it, and they said it indicated a car was approaching the area. The blond man went to the wall of the craft where we had entered, passed his hand over a pulsating blue light to the right, and again the invisible door opened out of nowhere. He beckoned and I got up quickly and walked to the opening. He asked me to tell the dog to leave. "Go home, Das, home," I said, and the dog, still sitting near the doorway, whimpered slightly, then walked off disappointedly. Again he passed his hand over the blue light and the door disappeared. We sat down again and he said we must leave the ground. Then the lights dimmed to a deep blue, then to a deep purple. The lens in the floor under Theetable lighted up. I could see through it, and it looked as if we were almost sitting on top of a dark grey Pontiac sedan. "We're parked on top of the car," I exclaimed. "No, you're at least a mile above it. The lens magnifies it like a telescope," he explained as we watched the activities below. The car door opened and a man and a woman emerged. The dark-haired man seated with us passed his hand over another of the pulsating lights visible through the tabletop and the image appeared as if in broad daylight. I could see everything clearly, even the blades of grass on the ground were clearly discernible. I let out a little cry of surprise. I recognized the two people below. The blond man motioned to the man at the control panel, who turned something and immediately I could hear the two voices as if the people were in the ship with us. The visitors didn't appear to be much interested in the scene below, but seemed to enjoy watching my amazement. The picture faded out and again I looked at them, this time without words. A few seconds later the lens picked up their car again, as it was speeding along the highway. Again the picture disappeared and the room lighted up. In what marvelous way were these people able to project color, light, sound? Surely it was a stupendous scientific feat. They seemed to take all of it for granted, as if the miracles were everyday accomplishments of their equipment. They remarked they were surprised we had not discovered some of these things ourselves. "We had the ability and resources," they said, "but lacked the know-how in applying the natural, physical laws of science." I was worried about my inability to fully comprehend all they were telling me. I had little or no education in the sciences. They told me not to worry, because many of their contacts were trained scientists who could understand their technology and now could even duplicate some of their instruments. "It's fairly easy to find contacts like these, Howard. But people like yourself is a different matter. Remember the story of Moses in your Bible? He was gifted with the knowledge of how to perform miracles, but apparently he wasn't a good talker. That's why he had to have Aaron as a sort of publicity man. While scientists can perform certain tasks, few of them would be able to bring the spiritual message to people, as you will be doing." They specifically mentioned a man from Yucca Valley, California, who they said was conducting experiments in some fields that were far advanced over our present-day scientific knowledge. I would meet him in the near future, they promised. "Would they give me his name?" "That's unnecessary. We'd rather let you have the fun of recognizing him, and it will be easy. Look for a fellow about 6 feet tall, well-built, blonde, young-looking for his age, with a charming personality, and a great amount of understanding. The man would be lecturing in New York soon, and they gave me the date. Just to make it a pushover for you to find him, take this down." And he gave me the name of the hotel, the room and telephone number. I was to telephone him upon his arrival in New York and arrange to have a private talk with him. I was told that we might work together, along with some other people who had been contacted. But again I was admonished, "Remember, try not to let the story out until the summer of 1957, because there is still much training ahead. There are just as many people who do not believe and are opposed to the very thing that you know is true, and who will work diligently against you and your fellow contactees. Without proper instruction and training in the proper presentation of this information, you will be at a loss to handle the situations which will come up. But nevertheless, they added they would assist me whenever it was possible. You know, Howard, a lot of our people are among you, mingling with you, observing and helping where they can. They are in all walks of life, working in factories, offices, banks. Some of them hold responsible positions in communities, in government. Some of them may be cleaning women, or even garbage collectors. But when you meet them, you will know them. 15. Gift of awareness. Our conversation terminated as the two men stood up. The blonde man passed his hand over the lights, and the chairs disappeared into the floor. Putting his hand on my shoulder, he indicated I was to leave. The man at the instrument panel waved to me as the other man who had been seated with Hughes walked toward the wall and again passed his hand over the blue light. The opening reappeared. The blonde man stepped out and I followed. Tass had returned and was waiting for me. As I shook hands with my blonde friend, he said, "May you go in peace in the light of our Infinite Father." A glorious uplifting emotion permeated my whole being, and again I felt humble and grateful for the privilege of being a small part of such a movement toward universal peace and understanding. I looked forward to more learning, and my space friends had told me that with understanding and development, certain gifts would come to me. The gifts would be natural talents, which they had developed centuries ago on their planets, such as telepathic communication, control of matter, space travel, and a quite amazing one which I was soon to discover. One night in my sign shop I teleported myself. I was working late in the shop. Many nights I worked into the early morning hours because the increased number of contacts had slowed down my production, while at the same time the increase in family responsibilities demanded more financial resources. Late at night in the shop I had peace of mind. It was a quiet place with no one to interrupt my aloneness with thoughts and problems. I remember that I was working on a large sign containing letters about 12 inches high. The radio, tuned to an all-night record show, was playing softly. I was finishing the word, swimming, and was halfway through painting on the letter G at the end of the word when my thoughts wandered to field location no one, about 9 miles away, where so many wonderful things had happened to me. For a few moments I didn't realize my thoughts were becoming strangely vivid. Then I realized I could see the field in its every detail, as the fluorescent light over my easel seemed gradually to dim and parts of the room faded out and finally disappeared. The light went from white to blue, to dark blue, and then everything blacked out. The next thing I knew I was actually at field location number one, standing in the open field, with the cool, dewy grass beneath my feet. Time seemed to hang in suspension. I was confused. What was I doing here? I tried to recover my bearings. Perhaps I had been called out on a contact and had left the house and come here, but how did I get here? Where was my car? Did I walk from the house? I walked around the field, hoping the fresh air would clear my mind up. Then I remembered the sign, and the half-finished letter G. The more I concentrated, the more I remembered, and finally I fully recollected. Having concentrated on this location, somehow I had just appeared here, teleported a distance of 9 miles. I remembered that the space people told me we live in a three-dimensional world, an illusion we perceive with our physical eyes. They said the physical body is but a part of an illusion, that we really do not exist at all as we think we do. The space people teach that the body is but a three-dimensional vibratory reflection or expression in the mind which the soul uses for a brief period on this planet. Most Earth people are prisoners of their bodies, while the space people control their bodies and other matter by use of the mind. They know and understand this to the degree that they can teleport themselves. Man on this planet has lost most of his innate abilities he once possessed by leaning on crutches, such as telephones instead of telepathy, automobiles and other vehicles instead of teleportation, and so on. He has turned toward materialistic, unnatural energies, instead of utilizing natural laws given to him by our Infinite Father to be used freely. Yet people on this planet consider themselves highly civilized. Actually, they have been going backward for centuries. It is true we have more gadgets, conveniences, TV set, radios, telephones, electronic machines, computers, and atomic bombs. But all of these things man creates only limit him. He is becoming a slave of his own inventions. How true was the expression of some wag when he twisted an old saying and came up with, "Invention is the mother of necessity." There is little need for complicated gadgets which we call conveniences. The mind is more versatile and powerful than any gadget ever created, if only we would use it. Our space friends cannot understand why we make things so complicated, doing things the hard way while calling it the easy way. They take primary energy from electrons present in our atmosphere and channel the force which surrounds each electron into all types of simpler conveniences which cost nothing to operate, utilizing, so to speak, a free energy. But we generate electrons, first, through brute force, then run the electrons along insulated wires where they again, through brute force, operate our complicated gadgets. The space people do not destroy the electrons, they merely take the power which surrounds each of them and use it constructively, then the released electrons go on their way, recharge and become usable again. Our method of handling electrons destroys them, for they are dissipated as heat in electric lamp bulbs, X-ray machines, radios and other electrical equipment. Some of these operations throw off toxic elements and damaging rays, which reminds us again of the principles of natural law. When we go against natural law, the results react against us. The space people had promised to show me instruments with which they can teleport any kind of matter, including human bodies, any distance, providing theories a transmitting and a receiving set at the points of departure and arrival. They could not understand, they said, why we had not accomplished this feat ourselves, since we were so close to it with our transmission of light energy in the form of images. In our now quite ordinary television sets we are able to convert light from three-dimensional bodies into electrical energy, then back into light energy and images. The secret of going much farther and transmitting matter itself is within our very grasp. In fact, some scientists have actually done it secretly. Everything one creates must originate as thought, which consists of vibratory reflections under control of the mind or intellect. Whatever man thinks, he can do. People who have the ability to teleport themselves also have the ability to use this potential to the highest degree. Telepathy is not, according to the space people, the mere sending and receiving of brain waves. What happens is a realization on the part of two individuals who are communicating that they are not limited by their physical bodies and they are not in a time field. They are in a timeless zone and are aware of all. Those who use it now and then are in both the physical third dimensional and the fourth dimensional reflection, without being able to break completely with the third. They experience an awareness of something other than physical, yet are still conscious of the third dimension. In ages past, certain glands under the brain were developed by people who at that time on this planet could use the glands frequently as an aid to telepathy and other natural talents. These glands are now degenerate and underdeveloped, just as man's muscles become lax in absence of proper exercise. The brain is an instrument of the mind. We communicate with each other by telephone in a roundabout way. The soul, expressing in the body, communicates its desires to the mind. The mind sends out thoughts through the brain. The brain converts the electrical energy into sound energy via our vocal cords. The sound is picked up at the receiving end of our telephone by a system of magnets, which changes the sound energy back into electrical energy. The electrical energy travels along wires to the other end of the circuit and is picked up as electrical energy and changed back to sound energy. The latter we perceive with our ears. Our ears transmit the sound energy to electrical energy through the brain, a physical, complex blob of billions of atoms spinning around each other, just like our solar systems. The electrical energy is then converted into thought patterns which translates the meaning to the mind. The mind, the communicator between soul and body through the instrumentation of the brain, is the recorder of our very existence. Teleportation is relaxed photographic perception in three-dimensional detail, involving light refractions, shadows, life sound, objects, smell, and in general, using all our five senses, plus the sixth one which involves utilizing the gland beneath the brain. In other words, you must perfectly visualize or image the scene to which you wish to be teleported, then you mentally become a part of the scene. Thus I tried to explain to myself my sudden and surprising change of location. As I continued walking and again thought about the shop and what I was doing there before coming to the field, I again experienced a peculiar sensation. First a bluish-green haze enveloped me, and the more I thought of the shop the clearer an image of it became. The field and trees became indistinct and hazy, the ground below me disappeared, I was not conscious of my feet or my body. I felt as if I had one huge eye, and that I was the eye, aware of the magnitude of space, unlimited, unending. Then the next thing I knew I was sitting on the chair at my easel in the same position as when I had left, with the peculiar feeling that I had just dropped my brush in the middle of the work and was reaching down to pick it up. I bent down to get it and found the brush was dry and hard. The unfinished G I had partly painted was dry. Then it was not my imagination. I had really been gone. Knowing the paint always required 15 minutes to dry, I knew I had been gone at least that long. Could it have been a dream? Had I fallen asleep? Had I done so, I would have fallen forward, or at least rested my head on their sign, which would have smeared the paint and ruined the sign. I would have got paint on my face and arms. Yet everything was intact. But I was never certain of just what had really happened until the matter was later clarified and explained by my friends. 16, Trip in an Alien Scout. Around the 1st of September, 1956, I again went to field location number 1. The many contacts had somewhat dulled my excitement until the awe-inspiring meeting the week before. Now as I saw the ship coming in, I hoped Eddie might have another surprise only half so wonderful, and in the back of my mind was always that small hope I would at last get the promise tried into space. The bright lighting faded and I could see the ship in detail. It was much larger than any of the others I had seen, and the actions of the two men who got out of it convinced me that something was up. They invited me on board, and I stepped into a large circular room. Again the light seemed to come from the walls, and the interior was similar to the one I had visited a few weeks previous, excepting this one was larger. The size was first evident to me when I noted the many chairs around the center table, contrasted to the three visible during the former visit. The table was also somewhat different. The most striking difference was a large coil-like apparatus, apparently made of gold, which rested on the center of the table. I assumed it had something to do with the lens beneath the table, though when I entered the ship the latter wasn't visible. Apparently they made it transparent and operable by turning it on in some fashion. Again three men made up the crew, yet I could see shadowy outlines of other figures beyond the lighted translucent walls in the corridor surrounding the circular room. I was not invited beyond the one room. Again one of the men sat at an instrument panel, another man stood near him, and the third man sat with me at the table. None of the men had said much, and I had learned it was a better idea not to ask questions, to wait until they were ready to tell me what I should know. "We're going to take you for a trip beyond the Earth's atmosphere," the man at the table remarked abruptly. Then he added, "We won't have any peace until we do. You've been after us constantly telepathically." The very serious look on his face changed, as one corner of his mouth twitched as if he was going to smile, and again I knew he was engaging in the deadpan humor some of the space people liked to affect. The view screen lighted to a beautiful view of the heavens, with planets greatly magnified against a magnificent background of stars. I saw a fleeting glimpse of the moon. Was that the moon? I asked him. Yes, we just passed it, he replied in a matter-of-fact manner. For the first time I realized we were already out in space. I had felt no jerk when we took off and thought we hadn't yet started. He was amused at the disbelief in my face. Watch the screen, he told me, and you'll see an interesting show in just a moment. Then I could tell we were moving by looking at the screen, since the stars seemed to be traveling slowly, horizontally across the screen. I did not know how the screen was oriented in regard to direction and half expected to see the stars flashing past us. To this day I do not have a good knowledge of astronomy. Suddenly I flinched. A huge rough-shaped object headed toward us. Again the man laughed at my amazement and I assumed we were in no danger. The object suddenly veered away from the screen and disappeared outside its field. Then I noticed other smaller objects which also veered away. Are those meteors? You're correct. They aren't quite as close as they appear, however, though our great speed makes it appear we're encountering a concentration of them, when actually they're far apart. Nevertheless, it was still nerve-wracking to watch them. Don't worry, Howard, should one move on a collision course with our ship, the flux around a hull would repel it and it would veer off to the side. Just then the man standing beckoned to me and I turned to my friend at the table, seeking permission to leave him. He nodded and I walked over to the other man. He pointed toward the wall where a porthole appeared in the same iris-like way their doors opened. Through the porthole I saw a hazy, whitish, fluorescent object which reminded me of a tennis ball hanging in a dark sky. I asked if it were one of their planets or the Earth. He smiled and waved his hand over a section of the instrument panel. Again I gasped in amazement. A few years ago I took my family to see Cinerama, the new motion picture process which employs a wide, deeply curved screen. When the picture began, my family and I sat there watching Lowell Thomas giving a lecture from a small black and white picture. But suddenly the curtains opened onto the famed roller coaster scene, and the hugeness and apparent reality of the giant picture suddenly bursting upon me, almost took my breath away. I grabbed onto my chair as the roller coaster made a dip, while my family laughed more at me than at the picture. That is the best way I can describe my amazement at looking toward the center of the room and seeing it change into a three-dimensional picture, but it wasn't flat like a screen, instead it seemed we were actually flying a few feet above the surface of a beautiful planet. Immediately I saw it was not Earth, and my question had been answered, one of their planets. The scene shifted rapidly. Sometimes we were about 10 feet above the scene below, but other times we were higher, possibly 100 feet off the surface. I saw beautiful dome-shaped buildings, with tiers spiraling upward. The planet was fantastically beautiful. I did not get the impression of cities, instead, I was reminded of beautiful suburban areas I have seen on our own planet, though, of course, wondrously different. The buildings were set in natural surroundings with large trees, which looked something like our redwoods, and gardens stretching in every direction. Then I saw forests, streams, large bodies of water. People, dressed in soft pastel colors, moved about. I also saw four-legged animals which were unfamiliar to me. Vehicles moved on the surface, apparently without wheels, for they seemed to float slightly above the ground. The operator of the marvelous picture show saw my interest in the surface vehicles. No, they don't move on wheels. We have very little use for wheels. In fact, we didn't go through the wheel evolution which has, in reality, slowed down your civilization, instead of having been the great boon you have been told about in school. You would have done better to have omitted it, as we did. The picture swirled and grew blurred, then disappeared. And again I could see the center of the ship. The show's over, he laughed, and don't ask me for a double feature. Almost before I knew it, the door opened again on field location number 1. The entire trip could not have lasted much longer than half an hour, though I had forgotten to look at my watch when I entered the ship. I walked the familiar route out of the field. Being back on Earth again after seeing a little of what lay beyond was almost like going to prison. 17. The witnesses. My work gained in momentum and the contacts were even more frequent. Now I propose to invite others to witness the craft and their occupants. Late in the summer of 1956, the visitors suggested a list of possible witnesses and indicated the time and location of a proposed landing. The big night turned out to be a dark, sultry night in late August when I brought a small group up to field location number 1. A sense of excitement pervaded the air. The witnesses consisted mainly of people from the surrounding community, but one was a physicist from a large eastern university. My own experiences had taught me to understand the emotions and feelings of people who were catching first glimpses of the visitors, so I watched over them closely and reiterated that whatever they saw, not, under any circumstance, to make a wild dash toward an unknown object or person, but to wait and observe. I knew that overhead a craft, dark, and out of sight, hovered, waiting. Then, on the ground, near the edge of the woods, pulsating lights appeared. We halted. I received the mental suggestion that it was all right to approach closer, and we moved toward the lights. Now we could see small disc-shaped objects of various sizes ranging from 8 inches to 8 to 10 feet in diameter, with differently colored lights pulsating. I knew these were observation discs similar to the one I had seen in April and that they were busy recording the thoughts, emotions and intents of the witnesses. I explained what the discs were, without elaborating on their recording mechanism. I remained emphatic that they were to approach no closer than 15 to 20 feet, though I hesitated to alarm them by telling them of the magnetic field. A few nights later I was told to invite the same witnesses again, since the visitors felt it was safe to allow them to have an actual look at themselves. The visitors landed about a quarter of a mile to the rear of the house in a secluded wooded area. They walked down to where the witnesses were waiting, hurdling a fence into the apple orchard, where I advanced and spoke to them in full view of the witnesses. These men from another planet were very tall, close to 7 feet, and I defy any Earthman to equal the physical abilities they displayed to the amazement of the spectators. One of their feet was leaping and at the same time giving the appearance of gliding over a fence 5 feet high and covering a distance of 20 or more feet in an abnormally short time. Once when headlights of an oncoming car on the road passing the property flashed across the orchard, the visitors jumped and ran about, as if trying to avoid the glare of the headlights. I learned later that the glare of our artificial electric lights, as well as our harsh daylight, is disconcerting and annoying, and in some cases, painful, to some of our visitors. The hazy, cloud-like atmosphere shell which once surrounded this planet has now gone, and as a result we receive the direct glare of sunlight without the protection of a natural filter. I walked toward one of the visitors, shook hands with him and exchanged a few words in English. I then turned and walked with the man, who was about a head taller than I, toward the spectators. He halted at a distance of about 10 feet from them. At the same time the witnesses were observing two the men and a girl. I believe I can better describe one of the witnesses' reactions by presenting a transcript of part of a radio program. It was to be one program in a series of unusual programs which would bring thousands of people to see me and hear my story firsthand. I am referring to the Long John Party Line show on Station WER, New York City, presided over by John Nebel, known affectionately to millions of listeners as simply, Long John. Nobody remembers exactly when Long John first began talking about flying saucers, but when he did he found his listeners preferred that he stop playing records altogether and spend the night, from 1 a.m. until daylight, interviewing interesting and controversial people. Long John would shockingly cry, I don't buy that. If I stated my belief that the space people themselves led him into pursuing the unusual format, thereby acquainting millions with startling and unfamiliar New Age subjects, which they subsequently took to heart, for he is still a skeptic regarding my story and other experiences he had presented. But I have a great debt to repay to Long John. In those early days he let me tell my story to his huge audience,